Last week we began a two-part series, and it's fine if you're here for the first time. I'll be reviewing some on the art of practice, and I wanted to begin the year really going over the fundamentals. So whether we were brand new or have been practicing for years, to really connect with the key components of the practice and build on that through the year. So we explored what we call formal meditation. And what I mean by that is where we're intentionally creating a space to sit or be quiet. But it's really for the sake of having all of our life included in practice. There's a Zen master, many of you have heard of, Suzuki Roshi. And one of his students came to him at one point and said, "What should a Zen practitioner do with his spare time?" So at first Suzuki Roshi looked perplexed, and he kept repeating the phrase, "spare time, spare time." And then he began to laugh uproariously. He couldn't stop laughing, like that was it. Like, spare time, as if there are moments that don't count as part of real life, you know. So really, we are practicing presence so that all of our life is real life. That we don't have those zones where we kind of trance out and think, well, we're trying to get somewhere else, or we're leaving something, or something needs to be different before we can really enjoy and relax. That is probably the essential torque, the trance that we hang out in, that it's not right now. And I talk about it a lot, the sense of being on our way, because it's really challenging to cut through it. And on some level, remember that whatever it is we long for, as long as we're trying to get it, we're trying to search for or get somewhere, we are overlooking the one possibility of real freedom and happiness, because it's only here. And it's such a habit to think, well, I'll really practice arriving here once I get X, Y, and Z done. Similarly, if we're resisting anything, if in some way we're thinking things should be different, any moment of resisting obscures or distances us from the one place right here where there's the awareness and heart that really is what we're longing for. So we practice so that all life is real life, so we can kind of dissolve that trance. Read you a very short part of a Rumi poem that I love. Once a day, once a week, five times an hour, it's not enough. Fish like we are need the ocean around us. Do you pay regular visits to yourself? Don't argue or answer rationally. Let us die and dying reply. Do you make regular visits to yourself? So what inspires us to gather together, what inspires us to, at some point in our days, take a formal sitting time to practice, it's not a should. It's not so we can be a good person or a better person, because ultimately the tension of that will contract the actual experience. The beginning of a really liberating practice is to connect with the depth of our aspiration. The way Rumi put it, he said, fish like we are need the ocean. We practice because our freedom, the deepest happiness, is when we really are here. And when we recognize this very awareness, this very presence, is what we're longing for. So last week I talk some about the power of getting sincere. Like in the moments that we listen and remember what matters. And really, I invite you to, if there's nothing else you do more of, it's that inquiry, what do I really care about? Because most of the trance is that we are doing this because we want that. And if you say, well, what do I really care about? What we find is that what we care about's only here. So it brings us back to presence. And we also find when we remember what we're longing for, we're coming home to who we are. We are most who we are when we're remembering that sincere longing. So last week I described the first step in the training, so to speak, as remindfulness. Because the given is that we forget. You know, the given is every day all of us have huge swaths of moments where we are tumbling into the future in our mind or remembering the past. In some way our minds are proliferating and we're absolutely not here. So remindfulness is that in us which notices, okay, off in the trance, thinking, worrying, come back. In the official parlance of meditation training, we use some form of concentration or take some object that we come back to as a way of kind of a home base so we can settle more with that in a very sensory here kind of way. So we choose the breath, our sounds, or you can even just feel the life in the hands and let that help you, you know, mentally sense here, right here. It helps to relax the body because in a way the tightness in our body is a way of trying to control or resist our experience. We try to quiet the mind because there's what's called nama-rupa, which is this body-mind cycle where the more we're having worry thoughts or busy thoughts, the more it trips off a biochemistry of anxiety that then trips off more thoughts, and hence we spend our day rolling through with busy mind and tight body. So meditation practice begins to cut through that. We have our anchor and we just keep coming out of the thoughts and coming right here. And we relax the body some to just begin to reconnect with a quality of ease and presence. Now, one of the questions I get a lot is somebody will say, well, this whole practice of noticing thinking and coming back to the breath, isn't it just so dry? It gets so boring, you know. And that comes from this misunderstanding that we're actually practicing to get rid of thoughts, or we're practicing so that we can learn to be with the breath. That is not the goal of practice. It's like we're preparing the garden by quieting the mind some and by relaxing in the body so that we can experience our full aliveness. It's the opposite of boring. There's a description of mindfulness that I like. It's really mindfulness and heartfulness, that we're bringing a wholehearted, full attention to what's right here. The qualities of mindfulness, and we're going to be spending time tonight on really mindfulness and heartfulness. The quality of mindfulness is non-judging, that we're noticing what's here and allowing it. There's a wonderful story some of you might remember. Some of you saw the movie Gorillas in the Mitts. I know Diane Fossey's this field biologist that manages to befriend a tribe of gorillas, and it's a great movie. But in it, she's following the footsteps of her mentor, George Schaller, and He's a primate biologist who, his renown came because he was the first one who returned from the wilds with more intimate and compelling information about gorillas than anyone had ever been able to get. And when they asked how he was able to learn such remarkable detail about the tribal structure and the mating habits and how they forage for food and so on, he attributed it to one thing. He didn't carry a gun. He spent his time watching without carrying a gun. And previous generations of observers had gone into these the territories of these large wild creatures and in some way assumed this kind of aggressive spirit and had guns, and it appeared that the gorillas could sense the danger and fear from these guys and just kept a distance. So he entered without a weapon, and he moved slowly and gently, and above all, really respectfully towards these amazing creatures. So I think that's a fabulous description of mindfulness, that there's this respectful presence towards whatever's arising within and around us. And instead of a gun, there's an allowing. We're not resisting what's happening. We're not controlling. There's this presence. So the two qualities that I feel are most helpful to remember when we're thinking about mindfulness, I describe in terms of an ocean and waves. That there's a quality of this openness, whatever's here, just including, sometimes the words this too. If you're practicing and you get a wave of anxiety or you get restlessness or some sort of a sense of sadness, okay, this too. So it's just space that you create, and that's the kind of ocean of presence. And then the other quality of mindfulness is the wave, it's wakefulness, it's noticing just this moment what's happening. So you notice the waves, but you create the space of the ocean with your mind. And that is sacred attention. So if you think of, well, what is mindlessness? It's the opposite. It's instead of having that space and that clear knowing, it's being in a trance. It's being identified with the waves that are coming and going and being in reaction to them. Mindlessness is when we have a gun. We're trying to control things. We're saying yes to this and no to that. So the challenge that comes when we have the intention of mindfulness and heartfulness is that when strong, difficult experience arises, we have a very deep conditioning to immediately pick up the gun that we thought we were going to put down. We have an immediate conditioning to judge it as bad, to try to fix it, to control it, to think our way out of it. We do it in our meditation sittings and in daily life. If you watch how the mind goes, the mind is always trying to figure out something to try to control the situation. So, another primate story for you. Once the English had colonized India and established their businesses, they yearned for recreation and decided to build a golf course in Calcutta. Golf in Calcutta, however, would prove to present a unique obstacle. Monkeys from nearby habitats would drop out of the trees, scurry across the course, and seize the golf balls. The monkeys would play with the balls, tossing them here and there. At first, the golfers tried to control the monkeys. Their first strategy was to build high fences around the fairways and greens. Now, this approach, which seemed initially to hold much promise, was abandoned when golfers discovered that a fence is no challenge to an ambitious monkey. Next, the golfers tried luring the monkeys away from the course. But the monkeys found nothing as amusing as watching humans go wild whenever their little white balls were disturbed. In desperation, the British began trapping and relocating the monkeys. But for every monkey they carted off, another would appear. Finally, the golfers gave in to reality and established a rather novel ground rule for that particular course. Golfers in Calcutta were obliged to play the ball wherever the monkey dropped it. So I think this is a great guideline for our practice, that the given is that these winds of the mind, these emotions, and the world around us is going to create experience that is not going to line up with our idea of how it should be. That is the given. Check it out in any given moment. There is so often this subtle dissatisfaction, like we're waiting for the next moment to contain what this moment does not. The monkeys aren't quite cooperating. Or sometimes more dramatically, this feels wrong. It shouldn't be like this. It's really amazing if you have a wave of fear to sense how much you think it's wrong that that's happening. We think it's wrong that we get sick, although everybody gets sick and everybody dies. We think there's something embarrassing and wrong about aging and dying. So the something's wrong feeling, we latch on to the way the monkeys are playing out in our life. So it gets very interesting when naturally we try to control and figure out and do a certain amount. But in the most important realms, I mean in the realms that really have to do with our relationships, our intimate relationships, and with the nature of these bodies and this earth, in the most important ways, can we learn to arrive right here and play the ball right where it is, not make it wrong? What happens if we try to control? Let's say anger comes up and we try to control by repressing it and shoving it under. We end up acting out in a more violent way later, or else getting a disease. Let's say anger comes in, our way of controlling is to then blame and violate. Then we just get more and more locked into the sense of an abused, victimized, or abusing self. We're even more stuck in smallness. So the Buddha's teaching is to neither repress or act out, but rather to be here, fully here, with that kind of courage to play the ball just where it is right now, just to say, it's like this. Sometimes we begin to get the freedom in the moment by just naming what's happened. If where the monkeys have dropped the ball is that you're feeling anxiety and you just simply go, okay, anxious, anxious. In the moment of naming, and this is the power of mindfulness, you wake up out of the sense of the victimized anxious self and become the awareness that's noticing. You reconnect with space, with presence. I had one yogi at a retreat last year who was getting wave after wave of self-judgment. And when we, in an interview, looked into it, she found that she was really doubting whether or not she could do this right. There was this doubt. And I talked to her about the hindrances, the basic universal forces that everybody experiences at some point. And many of us get these multiple hindrance attacks, as you know. And I said, so this is doubt. It's like this is part of what happens. The Buddha experienced it on the day of his awakening. It was the biggest challenge he experienced. And she found that for the rest of the retreat, whenever the self-judgment would come, she'd go, oh, it's the doubt. It's the doubting hindrance. And if she could name it, she wasn't identified with it. There was some freedom. So this is one of the first and major tools in the art of practice, is this recognizing the wave, recognizing, oh, the monkeys have landed it right here, the ball's here, it's like this. I was teaching at Kripalu this summer and talking about the power of being able to just acknowledge, okay, this is what's happening. Not fighting it, not fixing it. Just acknowledge it, and then how we can move forward with some wisdom. And one of the men at the retreat described to me how his 10-year-old daughter had had a really scary dream, and following the dream, she and her parents had these very intense talks about death and dying, because the dream was about her own death. And 2 days after their talks about her dying, that everybody dies, she handed her father her will. She had written up a will. All my jewelry goes to Annette. All my crystals to Lauren. All my clothes to Annie. All my furniture to my parents. She had written up a will. But after that, she was okay. And there was something when I heard that, there was some simplicity of, they had talked about it and it was difficult, but it's like this. And no doubt she'll have many more rounds of deepening, coming to terms with the realities. But there's a power when we don't try to fix or change, but just say, okay, it's like this. With the most challenging ones, when we really feel snagged, we will do everything but be here. And part of the path, the art of practice, is to know your particular strategies for leaving. Some of us get very, very left brain and get really analytic and try to figure everything out. Others go numb. Many of us use addictive behaviors to try to soothe our nervous system. Many of us get very, very busy. To notice, what is my way of running away? And then gradually, as we're able, we're really learning to stay. We're learning when it gets quaky and off balance and uncomfortable not to get occupied. We're learning remindfulness. Okay, here. Right here, just to be with this. Another friend had a repeating dream. This was a man in his 50s, and he had had it for decades and decades, the exact same dream they told me about. And in this dream, he was walking in the, he'd always be walking in the dark. He'd be walking on some pathway that was kind of in a woodsy area. And then he'd feel this kind of hot, shadowy entity behind him. Never saw anything, just feeling it behind him. And he'd hear its breath in his ears. And then he'd go faster and faster, he'd walk faster and faster, and the breath would get louder and louder, and the terror would greater and greater, and then he'd always wake up sweating and panicked. And this kept happening year after year after year. And then he got, he went through therapy where he would analyze in detail all the different parts of it, and you know how in some of dream therapy you kind of have the ending come out differently and so on. Nothing. Just kept happening. And then he started practicing meditation, and he got the message of the learning to stay. One night, finally, the same thing happened. He felt that heat and that shadow and heard the sound of the breath. But that time he didn't run. And there was some sense in him of choosing to be here. He reported that. And he said he turned around and he was terrified and he looked into blackness and emptiness. And he was absolutely still and he could hear his own breathing and feel the terror getting greater. And then the terror kind of ended up flooding him and then turned into this enormous bottomless loneliness, like he had never, like a sense of aloneness that was loneliness that was excruciating, and then grief. And he said that when he woke up, he felt, he had tears in his eyes, but he said he felt a freedom and a peace that he had never experienced in his whole life. He had stopped running. Each of us has some core existential wound and fear that we're running from. And when we slow down, or when we say, okay, I'm not going to follow the thoughts, I'm just going to be here, we can feel that squeeze of anxiety. We can feel the tightness that we've been running from. And it might take the shape of shame, and it might be fear, and it might be excruciating loneliness. But it's not until we really stop leaving in our thoughts and just stay, that we can rediscover that presence that really is the only place of peace and really is where the freedom is. Ghalib, the poet Ghalib, writes, "For the raindrop, joy is in entering the river. Travel far enough into sorrow, tears turn into sighing. When after heavy rain the storm clouds disperse, is it not that they've wept themselves clear to the end?" For the raindrop, joy is in entering the river. Travel far enough into sorrow, tears turn into sighing. When after heavy rain the storm clouds disperse, is it not that they've wept themselves clear to the end? So one of the understandings in this practice is that when we stay and we allow the phenomena to unfold itself as it is, it comes and it goes. And what we discover is the presence that has always and already been here, but we weren't able to sense it because we were so busy running and fighting and resisting. So it's a training in bravery to really be here. And that doesn't mean that whatever's arising, we always stop and be with it. There are times that we don't have the resilience or balance or humor or perspective or whatever it takes to really be there. And in those cases, we do what we need to just nourish and take care of ourselves. But eventually, and I like this description of it, that it's like we open the doors and the windows of our heart and our being so that the winds can just blow through freely. We don't keep tensing against life. So we'll practice a little with this mindfulness of being right here. And as you know, with these, it's a short kind of exploration where you'll have an opportunity to choose something that you might run from or push away or not want to be with, and just maybe tonight find a little bit more space to be with, which is the idea. Okay? So sit in a way that's comfortable enough. And begin as we do with that sincerity of intention, just to be here. The sincerity of intention for presence. To be as awake, as open as we can. And then just feel yourself arriving. If the mind's been following the thoughts and ideas I've been talking about, just sense that kind of here, right here feeling. And And letting the senses be awake. Notice if in being right here, if there's any physical or emotional discomfort. If there's anything you're pulling away from, resisting, if there's anything that wants your attention, and it might be that there's something going on in your life that's holding tension in your body right now that wants your attention. So this is a time just to sense if there's a situation that's difficult, or if just right here, right now, there's some unpleasantness and sensation, some tightness in your heart. If there's any way that you're at war with your experience, just to sense that right now. Sometimes the question, is there anything that's getting in the way of being wholeheartedly here? And then with this kind of listening attention, explore what it means to just stay with what you're noticing. A kind of gentle, respectful attention. What is it like just to feel in your body, the throat, the heart, the belly? How might difficult experience play in your body? Can you just let it be? And notice what it's like with a careful attention. It might help for some just to name what you're noticing. For some, it might be restless or sad, sleepy, fearful. Let the noting or naming be a friendly kind of labeling. And then see if you can just feel it as sensations. Breathe with what's here. If there's a sense of what's going on, kind of possessing, taking over, then to explore more the ocean, the awareness that it's floating in. You can do that by listening to sound, by softening around wherever the experience is intense, soften your hands. Maybe sense the half smile. Give it some space. To be mindful is to notice what's happening and allow it. Agree to the moment. This too. Often we'll try to leave by thoughts. It's unconscious kind of exit strategy. To not judge that, but to gently notice and arrive again. What's here? Can you notice and say yes to what's right here, no matter what it is? Okay, so opening your eyes. So when we practice mindfulness, we don't go hunting necessarily for something challenging, but I wanted to give you a little bit of a taste of how do we stay when our habit is to leave. And I want to just check in and see if you have any questions thus far on the practice of mindfulness, on anything that we've described today, because I just want you to know if you have a question, it's going to be valuable for others, I promise. I just want to check around. Any questions thus far? Yeah, please, and try to speak up a little. So the question is, when you're quieting and when you're starting to meditate, you're getting visual images from something from the day. No need to get rid of anything. You're being mindful because you're noticing. You can sometimes put the label, oh, mental images or visual images. And if they're pleasant, you can even say pleasant, pleasant. The idea is to know that you're here, to be aware, not to get rid of any of the objects of awareness. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, in the back. Okay, I'm going to repeat this. The question, the comment is, with whatever comes up, I can work with it. I can be with it. It can pass. Fear comes, uh-uh. It not only stays, but it's really, really hard. It's like terror, and it just keeps on staying no matter what you try. First, just to say that is what you're observing, and you're really being awake in this, is that that fear is at the core. Fear is the bottom line. In fact, one description of spiritual awakening is learning to be with fear. Because it's the core experience that we organize our life around, not feeling. We're all running from fear. And if we can get away with it, if we can numb ourselves or stay busy or keep thinking our way away from our bodies and where it lives, we will. So part of the practice is to sense, okay, how can we kind of, with a tremendous compassion, begin to find more presence with the very thing we most don't want to experience. That's the inquiry. So you're really naming it just right. If it's traumatic fear, we need help. It's not like go to your meditation cave and gut it out. If it's traumatic fear, we can re-traumatize ourselves if we take the instructions, okay, open to it, breathe with it, let it be as big as it is. You can eventually practice on your own with traumatic fear, but there's a chance of just re-traumatizing, and we really need the support of a bigger container. When I say a bigger container, when there is somebody that's trusted or that loves us, that's with us, there's some remembering of a bigger space that can help hold the fear. But unless there's some sense access to something that has some safety and love to it, we get too knocked around. So that's number one. If it's really traumatic, have a therapist, a teacher, a friend, somebody help hold a space as you begin to touch in. Okay. If it's not traumatic, it can still be incredibly intense and feel really, really difficult because that's the nature of fear. And as those of you that have been here with me over the last years know, I give a series of talks just on fear. And so I'm just giving a nutshell summary. But the bottom line is to be able to feel it in our body, but also remember something large enough to help us have some space for it. I call that taking true refuge. We're not taking the false refuge of numbing it with alcohol or telling ourselves that we don't really feel it. We take the true refuge of remembering where love is, remembering the natural world that has room for our tears and our hurts. We take refuge by really remembering a kind of loving presence that's really who we are that can begin to hold it. And I'm going to use the very last part of tonight to give some ideas on pathways to what is the space that's big enough for fear. But I feel like what you're bringing in is the question that we're all grappling with. It's the core challenge. So thank you. Please. Okay. So the question is about mental noting or labeling. And what this gentleman's saying is that sometimes he can't quite figure out what it is. It's kind of amorphous. And you'll say anxiety, but it's not quite like that. The purpose of noting is, A, by trying to note or label, it helps to bring the attention to what's there more, and then it helps you to actually experience it more directly. But no need to go through a kind of mental thesaurus, and there's no striving. If it's not, oh, restlessness, or oh, sadness, or, you know, or even if you can name the sensations, well, tight, burning, twisting, aching, that can be useful. But if it doesn't come, drop it. Because what really we're doing this for is just to offer our presence as well as we can to what's there. So just keep breathing and feeling your body, and that'll be plenty. Okay. And thank you. Yeah. Yeah, please. Does engaging in this practice accelerate or give rise to more karmic challenges? Ah, that's an interesting question. The more you pay attention, the more the layers of experience that you have been running from or pushing under will be free to present themselves to the light of awareness. So in that sense, you might find that there's a season in practice where you actually open to feelings of doubt or shame or fear that you hadn't really tapped into just because you're more present to notice them. So in that way, yes. But on another way, it begins to dissolve the karmic challenges because the very nature of being present with our experience shifts our sense of who we are. So rather than continuing in the small self story, in other words, the biggest karmic challenge we have is that we forget who we are. Our biggest suffering is that we're not realizing who we are. That's the biggest karmic challenge. And the more moments that you're present, the more you begin to trust that who you are is the loving presence, the space that life's happening in. And that begins to dissolve a lot of the reactivity and challenge that we live with day to day. So yes, more intensity presents itself, but there becomes more space, more peace, more wisdom to meet it. Yeah, so thank you for that. So I think we'll keep going because I want to, let me just time check here. Yeah, I want to just add one more piece for tonight, kind of emphasize mindfulness, and I'd like to talk a little more about the heartfulness, or the awakening of the heart that allows us to hold what's difficult, i.e. fear. Because I feel like that's kind of where the direction of the evening's going. And to say that there's a reason that vipassana, or that these kind of trainings in mindfulness are taught hand in hand with compassion and loving kindness. And that is because if the heart isn't soft, if there's not an openness to the heart, we won't be able to stay with what's difficult. It's the heart quality that actually is the refuge that makes room. It's kind of like that wonderful saying that if you remember you're the ocean, you won't be afraid of the waves. Love reminds us that we're the ocean. So how, this is the koan, how when we're caught in the trance, do we kind of reconnect with with loving presence. One of the stories I love of there's a director of a medical facility on the East Coast, a very compassionate, wise doctor who spent part of his time working with people that were very poor, that were homeless, that were had mental disturbance. And one woman would come to see him once a month, and she'd just tell him all her problems. And he really held her with a respectful attention and just was very quiet, and now and then would try to help her problem solve, but mostly just saw the goodness in her and offered just a listening presence. And as it turned out, she started coming to his office when he wasn't there, and that some of the nurses noticed that she'd go to the edge of his room, and she'd come kind of once a week when he wasn't there, and she'd put her right foot into the room, and then she'd pull it back, and then she'd put it back in again, and pull it back, and she'd do that for a few minutes, and then she'd leave. And it was as if she just needed to connect with that space where there was enough kindness for her life to be held well. I sometimes think of it like the fear and the shame and these other kind are like kind of these shadowy creatures that are very shy and buried there. And it's not until we really offer the light of our a kind of an invitation of love, of if there's a quality of care, that they can come into the light of awareness and really unfold and move on, and that we can come back home to a quality of peace. So the pathways, what this doctor offered this woman, we can begin to offer ourselves. A really kind space of presence. And that can be part of our intention when we first sit. It can be that we come and we get to that sincerity. And I know for myself, I'll just say loving presence. Can I remember loving presence? Because it's what we are. And then I know that that field can hold whatever comes up. So one of the pathways of bringing this heartfulness into the moment is when it's difficult. Let's say we feel the clutch of fear, and I'll keep using that as an example right now. We feel it, and as many of you know, I find it really helpful sometimes to put our hands on our hearts, because there's some way that that's physicalizing this offering of presence. And if we can feel that fear and at the same time offer care, like, I care about this suffering, or may I be free from suffering. Or as in some of you might remember the Hawaiian healer that says, I'm sorry, I love you. Try it. Next time you're really stuck, feel the pain, but at the same time, just offer that whisper, I'm sorry, I love you. And if you don't like those words, some message of caring presence, because that's what that is. I'm sorry, I love you reminds us that there's this energy of caring that's bigger than the fear. There's an ocean that can hold the waves. So this is the karuna practice. That's compassion practice. We feel what's difficult and we offer care. We can offer it to our own heart. It's also helpful to remember others that are struggling. When we're afraid, when we remember the others that are also struggling, we remember our belonging. And in any moment that you offer care in your heart to another, you re-inhabit an enlarged sense of being. So offering to your own being, offering to others, and finally, to call on the love, the spaciousness, the vastness, to pray for it so that you can feel that. Because even though it seems like you're praying for something out there, you're really calling on the truth of what you are. Read you a poem and then we'll practice a little. This is the poet Hafiz. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. So in the moments we say, I'm sorry, I love you, or we call on some sense of the beloved, of loving presence. And it could be a sense of the Buddha or Bodhisattvas or Divine Mother or someone that we know that's loving and we just sense the energy coming through them. In those moments, we sense the light that's always and already here but we had forgotten that helps us hold the fear. So this is just a kind of beginning flavor of how the heartfulness and mindfulness come together, that we feel what's here and we call on the space of love to help hold it. So we'll do a final practice together. Just to sit in a simple way, just feel your intention for loving presence, to connect with an open-heartedness. Feel the sincerity of longing, of the heart's longing to be free, awake, in love. And in this sit, to just let go of the thoughts over and over again, to choose not to follow them. To let go into the mystery of what's right here. And if in this changing flow there's any hurt or fear, just to be willing to feel what's here as it is and offer care. Whatever's here, can you simply notice and allow with a profound tenderness? It's okay. It's okay. Caring presence. The gift of sacred attention, of being with what is the blessing of realizing what we are, that we are the presence that's attending. We are the presence that's holding with love. that the fears come and go, the sounds, the sensations. But what is timeless is this presence that holds this life. Closing as we opened with the sound current of Om, we'll chant three times, feeling with the chanting this offering of the heart, this prayer for connection for all beings, this prayer that all beings can awaken to loving presence and be free. Please inhale.
Teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.